1939, by which time about 10% of Palestine's adult male population had either been killed, injured, arrested, or exiled. The British government really needed a solution. So here comes another report.
The commission is studying the 20-year-old Jewish settlements in British-mandated Palestine.
The 1939 White Paper created a conflict between the British and the Zionists for the first time, because it rejected partition and said the solution was for Palestine to gain independence within 10 years, with everyone living there sharing it together. Crucially, it also imposed severe limits on Jewish land purchases and immigration. To the Zionists, this felt like a betrayal. In response, some set off bombs across the country, killing dozens of Palestinians. But soon, everyone was distracted by something much bigger. More than 60 million people were killed in World War II, including 6 million Jews murdered in Nazi death camps. Jewish survivors fled Europe, with a large number of them trying to find safety in Palestine despite the British limit on Jewish immigration. This set off a more direct confrontation between the Zionists and the British, with Palestinians often targeted as well. The Zionists knew two things. Militarily, they were stronger than the Palestinians, and Britain was exhausted by World War II, so it wouldn't have the stomach to keep fighting in Palestine. They were right. In 1947, after 30 years of occupation, Britain announced it was quitting Palestine and asked the newly formed United Nations to clean up its mess. Alright, 1947 and 1948 are the most pivotal years in this story, so let's take a look at how things are lining up. During British rule, Jews had gone from 10% to 30% of the population, and owned about 6% of the land. Under Ben-Gurion's leadership, the Jewish Agency was pretty much functioning as a government for the Jewish community. And the Zionist militias had tens of thousands of soldiers, modern weapons, and officers who'd already fought in World War II. On the other side, the Palestinians hadn't been allowed to develop their own administration or military. But as they waited for the UN solution, they were still the majority all over the country. In November 1947, the UN, then only made up of a fraction of the world's countries, voted to partition Palestine. This plan marked off 55% of the country for a Jewish state, but the UN never explained how it could be a Jewish state when half the people in its territory were Palestinian. To nobody's surprise, Palestinians, and in fact all Arabs, rejected the UN's plan. Ben-Gurion and the Zionist leadership accepted, but they saw an opportunity. With the British on the way out, the Zionists knew they would have the strongest military in Palestine. Their forces were instructed to seize more territory than they'd been awarded by the UN, and to do what was necessary to reduce the number of Palestinians in it. In cities like Haifa, the militia set off car bombs in Palestinian neighborhoods. They attacked villages and forced residents out.
Haganah troops have driven the Arabs out of the beleaguered city, taking many prisoners.
After inspecting parts of Western Jerusalem that had been emptied of Palestinians, Ben-Gurion said,
"In many Arab neighborhoods in the West, you do not see even one Arab. If we persist, it is quite possible that in the next 6 or 8 months there will be considerable changes in the country, and to our advantage."
One of the events that helped speed up these changes took place on April 9th, 1948, when the village of Deir Yassin was attacked. A British government report to the United Nations describes the scene. 250 people were killed in circumstances of great savagery. Women and children were stripped, lined up, photographed, and then slaughtered by automatic firing. The story of what happened at Deir Yassin set off panic all over the country. As news spread, people fled, fearing they would be next. Historians have recorded dozens of similar massacres during this period. Each time, they would result in entire communities fleeing. By the time Britain ended its mandate on May 15th, 1948, 250,000 Palestinians had fled. The night before, David Ben-Gurion announced the founding of the State of Israel, with himself as its first prime minister. He was standing under a giant portrait of Herzl, 51 years after Herzl had predicted this very moment. The Zionist militias came together as the newly formed Israel Defense Forces, but the fighting wasn't over. With the British out of the way, soldiers from several Arab countries entered Palestine. But the Israeli army was better equipped, better organized, and unlike the Arab armies, had a unified command and backing from several European countries. Israeli forces pushed into places that the UN had assigned to the Palestinian state, like the towns of Lidda and Ramle. 50,000 people were forced to flee from there, many on foot, in what became known as the Lidda Death March. After being emptied, the towns were given Hebrew names, Lod and Ramla. Like in many other empty towns, the buildings and homes were taken over by the new Israeli state and given to Jews. By the time the UN secured an armistice, three quarters of the Palestinian people had become refugees. In Arabic, they call this the Nakba, literally the catastrophe. The new state of Israel made up 78% of what had been Palestine. The remaining parts were annexed by Jordan or taken over by Egypt. A year later, the UN passed a resolution calling for all Palestinian refugees to be allowed to return home. They never have been. Palestine had been erased. In the decades since, attempts to resolve this conflict have again tried to partition the land. With each successive attempt, the territory offered to Palestinians in their historic homeland shrinks even more. Ironically, Israel is still struggling to maintain the population advantage it gained in 1948 when it forced all those people out, because in 1967, it occupied the West Bank and Gaza, bringing all the Palestinians living there under its rule. And so today, the population of Jews and non-Jews in this land is roughly equal. But those living under occupation have no rights, no citizenship, and no prospect of independence. The Nakba-era tactics of settlement, home demolitions, and expulsion are still used against them. Israel has taken the land but wants nothing to do with the millions under its rule. International, Israeli, and Palestinian human rights groups say this system is a form of apartheid.
WRCT Pittsburgh.
No matter how large or small your digging project may be, no matter how urban or rural, you must always call 811 before any digging project. 811 is our national one-call number, alerting your local utility companies to come out and mark any lines they have near your dig site. So before you do this or this, make sure you do this. For digging projects big or small, make the call to 811, brought to you by Common Ground Alliance.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
There was a young man organizing the march named Byard Rustin. Mm-hmm. And when Byard called people, you couldn't say no. Byard was, he was Dr. King's lieutenant, but he had the capacity to organize hundreds of thousands of people. And when he has a plan and a program, you know, he calls you and he tells you how the whole thing depends on you. If you don't show up, you don't do what you're supposed to, the whole thing is going to collapse and it's going to be blamed on you. Byard reached out to me and to Ruby and just said, we need somebody to MC the first part of the program in the March on Washington while the people are assembling. There needs to be entertainment and we need somebody to sort of keep it going. So Ruby, you and Ossie, you are selected.
The late Ossie Davis. For 7 decades, Davis led a distinguished career as an actor, writer, director, and producer. Along with his beloved wife, Ruby Dee, he was a renowned civil rights activist and an unforgettable figure in the African-American struggle for equality. In 1946, he began his acting career in Harlem. He made his film debut in 1950 in the Sidney Poitier film, No Way Out. Davis experienced many of the same struggles that most African-American actors of his generation underwent. He wanted to act but did not want to play stereotypical subservient roles such as butler that were the standard for African-American actors of his generation. Instead, he tried to follow the example of Poitier and played more distinguished characters. When he found it necessary to play a Pullman porter or a butler, he tried to inject the role with a certain degree of dignity. In 1998, Davis and Ruby Dee published their dual autobiography, In This Life Together, in celebration of their 50th wedding anniversary. On February 4th, 2005, Davis was found dead in Miami, where he was making a movie. I'm John L. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Ossie and Ruby, In This Life Together, In Black America.
In the Hollywood entertainment industry syndrome, professional or an actor is looked on as a celebrity, as a commodity, and is taught to teach the public to worship himself or herself as an object of divine whatever. Mm-hmm. And if you begin to consider only yourself, if yourself is your only object, then all other things will begin to fall away from you. You have to learn in this business that yourself cannot be your only object. You have to say, myself and my wife and my children, those are the things that mean the most to me, and I don't care what fame does or celebrity does. That's where I will be going, and that's where I stake my claim. You have to be tough and say, I'm going to make this marriage work because if I lose this one, the only thing I can do is get another, which will be just like it, so I might as well make this one work.
Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee were one of the most revered couples of the American stage, two of the most prolific and fearless artists in American culture. As individual and as a team, they created profound and lasting work that has touched all of us. With courage and tenacity, they often broke new ground for African Americans and opened many a door previously shut tight to African American artists. This generation may recognize Davis and Dee for their appearances in several Spike Lee movies, including Malcolm X, in which Davis played himself, having delivered the eulogy for the slain civil rights leader. Born on December 18, 1917, in Cogsdale, Georgia, the oldest of five children, Davis grew up in Waycross, Georgia. On December 9, 1948, Davis and Ruby Dee were married. In 1950, they made their film debut in No Way Out with Sidney Poitier. and then starred together on Broadway in A Raisin in the Sun. In honoring this legendary couple and celebrating the birthday of Davis, In Black America presents this rebroadcast of a 1998 interview regarding the publication of their dual autobiography.
I finally persuaded Ossie to write this book, and after 50 years later, you know,
mm-hmm.
and so we finished that. William Morris is publishing it. It chronicles our lives from before we. I mean, it's about our lives from before we met each other to when we met, and all through our time up until now.
One seems to forget that all of us are human beings under our stardom or whatever our vocation. Was it difficult in going back and reliving those early years?
Not difficult in an emotional sense.
Sometimes it was that too.
It was that. But what was difficult was that we found that we had different memories often of the same thing.
The same thing. Okay.
And sometimes we couldn't reconcile our differences. So I wrote my version. Ruby wrote her version. May the best contestant emerge triumphant.
And then sometimes it's conversation. Sometimes it's, dialogue. Mm-hmm. And then we take chapters. The format kind of varies, you know, like that.
Like life does.
Mm-hmm.
How long did it take you all to put this work together?
Two solid years.
But Ossie wasn't solid because in between that we were working. One of us would be away, and thank God Ossie's the writer in the family. So he kind of kept us on track, and we were working with a wonderful well-known Sidney Mahone, whom I known as a dramaturg, and others were helping us with research. So that was, we had, and our children sometimes, especially my daughter Nora, helping us with the memories when they were small. And so it was, so that helped a great deal. But I have to I just had to quarrel a little bit with that word solid. And also those times when we had some disagreements too about this and that.
But we never came to blows.
No, we never came to blows.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Davis, are you still your own editor and censor?
I am still my own editor and censor, but I found out that a lot of people have gotten into the act. So it's me and a whole board of directors telling me what to do.
Tell our audience how you all met in 1948.
Well, now, let's talk
your
about
version.
That a minute here.
Your version.
Yes.
We were both involved in a play called Jib.
Mm-hmm.
And we met at the New Amsterdam Theater on 42nd Street in New York.
Yes, is that where the Lion King is now?
Yeah, mm-hmm. That first day at rehearsal. And it didn't seem extraordinary to me at all. And
I came on board as an understudy, see?
Yeah.
And I had seen his picture in the paper, but I hadn't met him. But I didn't even like his picture because I had wondered some other people I knew from the American Negro Theater, that's the community theater where I got into the business. I wanted one of those guys to get the lead. So I was really very disappointed. And then when I saw him, it was even worse because I thought he looked so peculiar. I was just, and his understudy and I used to sit in the auditorium and kind of talk about him, you know,
mm-hmm.
because he was this tall, skinny guy that looked like with this big Adam's apple that went up and down when he talked, and he kind of like spilled along out of his, and hung out of his clothes. The clothes were too, you know, it's like this tall, skinny guy wearing the clothes of this short, fat man. he just looked strictly from poverty, but he didn't seem to be self-conscious about it or anything.
I had my mojo going.
But we agreed that he was a good actor, you know.
And that's how it all got started.
You all have been very involved with the activism of this country. How has that paralleled you all's acting careers?
Well, first let me say that we have been involved in activism in our country, but remember, activism has been involved with us.
I understand.
We were born black, and when we married in 1948, being black was not a happy state of affairs in this country. There were many places where people couldn't vote. People were still getting lynched. Soldiers returning from the war were being killed if they lined up to vote. So when we came into the theater, we were already in the midst of the struggle of our people for dignity and work and freedom. We had no option. There was no way of get out of being black, you know. Mm-hmm. So you had to get buckled down and struggle.
And also our parents. I think about my mother walking picket lines on 125th Street. We went with her, picketing for jobs in the stores where we couldn't work, but we could only go there and buy. We couldn't own stores on 125th Street. You know, I remember that kind of activity since I remember, and the poverty and the people being put out in the street. So we were kind of born, both of us, from different parts of the country.
Mm-hmm. And I remember on two occasions when my father's life was threatened by the Ku Klux Klan. And on one occasion, we stayed up all night waiting for the Klan to come. They didn't come, but we got the message, you know. So struggle was always a part of who I was and a part of who Ruby was.
And also it was part of the marriage, too, because the times that we live in affect you in personal ways, too. I preceded Women's Lib, and as I look back, that affected me a lot because I had no ways of thinking about what I felt was ailing me, what I felt was wrong with my being married and all that thing. You know, once I got used to it, and I said, oh, this thing is unfair. This is it's lopsided, you know, when it comes to the involvement of women and men. And so the whole thing struck me after we got married. So through as I began this quest, this scratching, this search, and honestly, being a sensitive person, thank God, we managed to scratch our way and move our way into another level of understanding as human beings. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. But part of it, I think, Ruby, was because we knew how to struggle even with each other. We knew how to fight with each other. Yeah. We knew how to try and arrive at some common truth that would embrace us both. And we had some marvelous examples when we came into the business. Paul Ropes and Candida Lee. Beautiful young lady named Lena Horne out in Hollywood fighting, you know. So there were examples all along the way that led us into the struggle. And we found that the struggle was our mother, and it kept us so busy that we never had time to stop and ask ourselves if we were happy. Yeah. You know, we didn't have time for that. There were too many.
The involvements were more important than any kind of like disagreements. That's how it seemed to work out. We had so much to do where there was some common thing happening.
Yeah.
We didn't have too long to spend on our personal things. Although we managed to have a few long pouts, you know, going.
Oh yeah, we had a full personal life. But you know, if you sit in front of the television in 1963, and you look at what's happening in Birmingham, and the dogs snapping at children, the water hose knocking people off their feet, you don't look at your wife and say, I wonder if I'm happy. You get mad as hell. You want to do something about it. You know, so the struggle catches you up in it. It's a part of who you are, and it certainly helped to keep us together and define who we were and what we had to do in this life. Struggle is the center of existence as far as we are concerned, and we intend to keep struggling until we die.
How did you all happen to become the MC of the March on Washington in August 63?
There was a young man organizing the march named Bayard Rustin.
Mm-hmm.
And when Bayard called people, you couldn't say no. Bayard was, first he was Dr. King's lieutenant, but he had the capacity to organize hundreds of thousands of people. And when he has a plan and a program, you know, he calls you and he tells you how the whole thing depends on you. If you don't show up, if you don't do what you're supposed to do, the whole thing is going to collapse and it's going to be blamed on you. Bayard reached out to me and to Ruby and just said, we need somebody to MC the first part of the program in the March on Washington while the people are assembling.
Mm-hmm.
There needs to be entertainment, and we need somebody to sort of keep it going. So, Ruby, you and Ossie, you are selected.
What was the feeling once you heard the I Have a Dream speech at the march?
Well, it was a quarter million people there, and it had been a most exciting day. And believe it or not, There had been some other very exciting speeches, but that certainly was the one that topped them all. And we found ourselves, after the speech, just sort of hugging each other, crying, laughing, and just feeling an explosion of joy in the bottom of our belly. Because Martin and Speak, when he said, "I have a dream," we knew he meant we have a dream. Mm-hmm. And we knew that we had arrived.
What has been the secret of these 50 years? If we could bottle it, we could sell it.
That's true. Tell them, Ruby, because I don't know.
I tell you the truth. When people first used to ask us that, especially young people in our travels, we kind of would give a flip answer, you know. Is it, well, we have managed to kill each other. Well, just do one day at a time. Well, just don't go to bed mad. We prefer about things like that. Mm-hmm. We did for a long time, but it occurred to us that they were asking serious questions. This relationship business is not easy.
Right.
You know, how to be together, man, woman, wife, sexual partner, temptation, jealousy, envy, resentment, you know, all these things creep into our lives to one degree or another, you know, and if you're lucky in marriage, we finally concluded, is a process. It's not something that you do. The wedding is something you do in a day, but marriage is something you do for the rest of your life every day, you know, around some issue, and I just feel it's kind of a percentage game. If there are more things around which you can agree and can enjoy life, then those things are for which you want to divorce, then that marriage feels like it's successful. The same thing with love. I thought I was in love when I first got married, but it wasn't many years into the thing when I realized that I was feeling some things that didn't belong with love, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We were going through some things that I questioned a lot of times, and many times when we have an argument, Ossie, we wake up the next morning, and Ossie would say, "Well, do you wish you'd married so and so?" You know, some question like that, and I get angry at the question, or he would say, "Well, if you're going to quit me, I'm going to go with you." So what, one thing that saved us in the rough times was a sense of humor. I tell you the truth, because we always. Eventually, we found something to laugh about. You know, the ridiculousness of what the things that were upsetting us, especially after they'd passed, and I used to get angry with him because I didn't think he was a good fighter. I didn't think he knew how to argue very well. And I think there's something about being able to argue constructively and creatively that sometimes it clears the air and gets some understanding, because then sometimes we'd have a fight, and the next morning, Ossie would tell me that he understood something. And eventually he began to feel with me about how I was feeling as a woman. And being a very smart guy, he would read up on the subject, he thought about things, and he began to reevaluate women. Me, his mother, women in general, this whole woman as object question, the woman as intellect, mind, me as a person capable of being of use in his work, and useful to him as a sounding board. I'm a good collaborator, but I had to kind of fight my way into his consciousness. I had to move beyond just being a woman. This marriage business is not easy, but we're hoping that this book will give young marrieds some idea, you know, because, for instance, we study everything in school but relationships.
Right.
The most important thing there's no compulsory course on marriage or child rearing or anything like that that affects us. You have to learn by trial and error. And if you're lucky, you hang together through the rough times and not think that every challenge is an end.
Yeah, and marriage is really what you make it. You have to make what it is you want. Now, in the Hollywood entertainment industry syndrome, a professional or an actor is looked on as a celebrity, as a commodity, and is taught to teach the public to worship himself or herself as an object of divine whatever. Mm-hmm. And if you begin to consider only yourself, if yourself is your only object, then all other things will begin to fall away from you. You have to learn in this business that yourself cannot be your only object. You have to say, myself and my wife and my children Those are the things that mean the most to me. And I don't care what fame does or celebrity does. That's where I will be going, and that's where I stake my claim. You have to be tough and say, I'm going to make this marriage work because if I lose this one, the only thing I can do is get another, which will be just like it. So I might as well make this one work.
I understand. You all were with Malcolm X a day or 2 days before his untimely assassination. Give us a little insight into the man.
Well, I think the last time we saw him, which was not too long before, he left us. He did come to our house by himself, and just Ruby and me and Malcolm sat, and we just listened and let him talk. Mm-hmm. And what was very apparent was that this dedicated, very brilliant, very strong character, very spiritual man, had one thing that hurt him more than anything else, and that was his estrangement from his father figure, Elijah Muhammad. Mm-hmm. He never really got over that. And so all of the things that we admired him for, we knew about and the public knew about. But when he sat to talk, and he talked and talked, we could see a young man, a boy, reaching out for a father who was no longer there. And that's the inner central core of my memories of Malcolm.
Miss D?
I don't know. I thought of I thought too of what racism does to us. We're all affected by it, and I think particularly black men, and particularly and women too in other areas like women. But this that his struggle against being relegated to niggerdom, mm-hmm. as Ossie talks about in the book. This thing that unfortunately happens in our culture it seems to be like a constant problem. This how do we reach through racism and love each other? And then Malcolm was that attempt for the manhood that Ossie wrote about, that reach toward that for all of us. You saw it all. He carried with him all the time, and yet he had a beautiful vulnerability and a nice sense of humor with that crooked little smile, you know. Mm-hmm. And but I think he was thrust in a direction that was that was more than just himself. He was a person sitting. I met him through my brother Edward, but he transformed my brother, and their families were very close. And then, but he was a man who was a public. He was a personification of black men in struggle, mm-hmm. and so he couldn't have. His personal life was second. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. You know, these people who walk the earth, right. They come here for more than themselves. They come here to live for a lot of people, just to be part of their aspiration and the thrust. Yes.
Is there a greater appreciation? I'm quite sure you love both venues, stage and film.
Well, I personally prefer the stage because I am a writer, and I find that writing for the stage means that you write a work that will exist on its own terms as long as printing exists.
Okay.
Unfortunately, the work that you do on film will not necessarily exist. Nobody goes and reads a film script,
mm-hmm.
and unless somebody takes care to preserve the film, it could very well disappear. So for me, since I'm a writer, stage is my first love.
Well, I can't say that I have a definite preference. I like them both for different reasons. I think there's nothing like a stage for hitting the walls of yourself, you know, finding out what you're all about, trotting the tracks, opening the pathways, and you do it over and over every night on stage. So there's a chance for growth and self examination and use of yourself over and over and over that makes it easier to get to from one point to another. This practice is like going through the path in an uncleared forest. The more you tread it, the smoother and more definite it gets. That's what I think the theater does. It explores the bigness of you and the wideness and the deepness of you, of yourself, and helps you to become a better actor on film, where you're looking, where the camera seems to photograph thoughts and emotions and ideas, and, you know, the subtleties with the camera can get there greater, I think, than on stage. But I think you grow more on stage than you do in film, although there are film actors who master that technique and are just as efficient there as, but I mean, to span them both, mm-hmm. I think a stage work is a necessary part of the training process, you know.
Have you all adopted Spike Lee?
Uh-huh. Not officially, but we're working on it.
He's adopted us, I think. I think with Spike kind of brought me into the attention of a new generation or something, you know, and also through our son, I think Spike taught a lot of people in the business. He had something about integrity, and I thought he did the film. The Delta Sigma Theta did it first, but he made a film by the bootstrap, you know. He just did it, and that's what the Deltas did with that film we made, Count Al Cusini. And he gave credit to all the people who helped him, and he took $5 and $500 and $1,000. And our son happened to be one of the investors. So I love Spike for that. He brought people into the union where it was the union. You know, was not known for being. It's kind of, it has a lot to do in terms of racism, and Spike worked on that front too. Everybody worked for Spike, you know, men, women, black, white, Asians, the physically challenged, all those. I mean, Spike he's a conscientious young man, growing philosophically, and so I mean, he's the most exciting person in that realm that I've known. You know,
you all have worked in virtually all the media, radio, television, film, stage. Any new projects on the horizon?
Well, Ruby has a couple of films in the can.
Yeah.
Passing Game?
The Passing Glory, yes, and where Quincy Jones was one of the producers, and David Salzman and Mike Magic Johnson. And it's a basketball film with Andre Brower.
And the next one is The Baby Geniuses.
No, well, that one is before then, really. The Baby Geniuses, that's coming out with Dom DeLuise. That was fun for me because I love doing those kind of
okay, could I get one in there,
yes,
lady?
Uh-huh.
All right, and I did one with Della Reese called The Secret Path, which has yet to show up. Meanwhile, we have other projects that we're busy working on.
The late Ossie Davis and the legendary Ruby Dee. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at jhanson, H-A-N-S-O-N, at KUT.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at KUT.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm John L. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 1 University Station, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 1 University Station, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
You are listening to Ebony Spectrum and also to In Black America. Hope you enjoyed that past program with Ruby Dee and Ossie Davis. And we have more information coming up for you. You know, it's Jazz Week at the University of Pittsburgh, and we have the schedule of different events. Starting today, which is Wednesday, November 1st, film screening of A Great Day in Harlem, a 1994 film, at the Cathedral of Learning and Room G24. On Thursday, November 2nd, will be the film screening of Hargrove, a 2022 film, with a question-answer session by the film's director, Elaine Henry, at the Public Health Auditorium, and that's Room G23rd. That's in partnership with the Kente Arts Alliance. Coming up on Friday, November 3rd, it's at 1 o'clock, it's a Visiting Scholars Series. Maya Cronfield, Retheorizing Spontaneity Between Jazz, Philosophy, and Toni Morrison's Verbal Art. That takes place in the Frick Fine Arts Auditorium. Also at 3:30 on Friday, it's an academic panel on Ahmed Jamal and Appreciation, moderated by Dr. Michael P. Mackey, with panelists Dr. Alton Merrill, Dr. Nelson Harrison, and Judge Warren Watson. That takes place at the University of Pittsburgh Hugh Hill Community Engagement Center, which is located at 1908 Wiley Avenue, Pittsburgh, PA 15219. Also on Friday, November 3rd, a solo piano concert featuring Benito Gonzalez at the Belfield Hall Auditorium. Coming up on Saturday, different events going on. At 1 o'clock on Saturday, November 4th, it's the Artist Seminar with Nicole Mitchell. At 2 p.m., it's the Artist Seminar with Victor Gould, which takes place in the Frick Fine Arts Auditorium, as well as the 1 o'clock presentation. At 2 p.m., it's a workshop with Camille Thurman, hosted by Dr. James Johnson, Jr. at the African American Music Institute, 7131 Hamilton Avenue, Pittsburgh, PA 15208. At 3 o'clock, it's an artist seminar with Kenyon Harold at the Frick Fine Arts Auditorium. And at 8 p.m. on Saturday, November 4th, it's the 53rd annual jazz concert at Point Park University's Pittsburgh Playhouse at 350 Forbes Avenue, Pittsburgh, PA 15222. Now, looking at the concert, we have concert week culmination with a concert featuring Victor Gould, Kenyon Harold, Camille Thurman, Charles Tolliver, Lenny White, Buster Williams, and Aaron J. Johnson at the Point Park University's Pittsburgh Playhouse. That's coming up Saturday, 8 p.m. Doors will open at 7:30. So be sure to check out all those different events coming up with the 53rd annual jazz seminar and concert by the University of Pittsburgh. As we continue on, we have more coming up here on Ebony Spectrum for you.
Angela Davis, thank you so much for joining me on Upfront.
Thank you, Mark.
In the midst of Israel's relentless attacks on Gaza, numerous black activists in the U.S. have expressed their solidarity with Palestinians, and they've called once again for an end to the occupation. Back in 2020 in Gaza City, in the midst of Black Lives Matter protests, a Palestinian artist painted a large mural of George Floyd, the African-American man, of course, who had recently been murdered by a police officer in Minneapolis. These two places are more than 6,000 miles away from each other, yet Palestinians and black Americans have found a common cause with each other's struggles. How does a moment like that, how do these moments come to be?
Well, Mark, for about as long as my political memory goes back, I think the causes of Palestine and black liberation have been intertwined. And I just can't imagine that those of us who call ourselves scholar activists, I can't imagine calling for justice for Palestine. I can't imagine the whole agenda of social justice in the world not including Palestine. In this respect, I think Black people in the U.S. and throughout the region of the West of this hemisphere should feel a very special tie to Palestinians. Of course, there is a long history, but I, you know, I think back to June Jordan, the incredible poet, when very few people were talking about the importance of supporting Palestine. June was upfront, arguing that it was not only necessary to support people in Palestine, but to recognize that Palestine itself is a kind of moral litmus test for the world.
Yeah.
Of course, Nelson Mandela said that South Africa would not be free until Palestine is free. So Palestine occupies a very central place in the political imagination of the last 50, 75 years.
A lot of people, when they hear the word solidarity, they think sameness. But the conditions between Black folk and Palestinians, the conditions are different in certain ways. How much of the solidarity movement hinges on us having the exact same oppressive conditions, and how much of it is about the broader systems of power that put us where we are? How do we, because I think a lot of people say, well, my life isn't like a Palestinian. And the Palestinian says, well, I don't have to deal with those things over there. How do you tease that out?
Those who assume that they live in a very small, insulated space in the world are just not recognizing conditions as they are today. We do not live in silos. We do not have our little bubbles in which we get to choose what affects us as individuals. You know, I think that what is really exciting about this last period, as much suffering as we have witnessed and experienced, is that we've seen movements against racism expand. We would not have imagined so many people identifying with these anti-racist efforts. And now, of course, we're seeing, you know, what we're seeing those who are reacting against it. You know, those who don't want to see us move forward in our understanding of the way in which racism in the U.S. is very much connected to apartheid in South Africa, which is very much connected to apartheid in Israel. Mm. So, yeah, this is a question that can't be answered abstractly. I think it's a question that has to play out in the course of the practice of solidarity.
One of the things that's come up in that practice of solidarity is conversations about the role of policing as well. For years, there have been exchange programs that bring together police, ICE, border control, FBI, all from the United States, along with soldiers, police, and border agents from Israel to share tactics on, quote-unquote, counterterrorism. Both the U.S. and Israel have been accused of repressive policing, of racial profiling, and they continue to sort of deepen their ties toward developing a kind of shared security model. When you see those relationships, what can we learn from that?
Well, those relationships link the militarization of the police in the U.S. and other countries to the leadership of Israel, the IDF, and which is trained police forces all over the country, it becomes clear, I think, that all these issues are intertwined. You know, let's remember that Cop City is developing in Atlanta,
and
precisely at a time when the police were on the defensive as a consequence of the struggles that were catalyzed by the lynching of George Floyd. the police were on a defensive for a little while, but now it appears as if they're trying to not only regain the position they had before, but move forward.
I was just thinking, it's not just governments either, right? I mean, private entities are also involved in these kinds of exchanges. For example, we've seen the export of security and technology from private Israeli companies that supply some of Israel's military equipment, surveillance equipment, for things like the separation wall between Israel and the West Bank. The same companies are working with the U.S. to provide technology for things like bolstering surveillance and militarization along the U.S.-Mexico border. When we see private corporations benefiting from oppression, even through the discourse and language of security, that complicates the analysis a little bit, doesn't it?
Well, I think that should probably be at the center of the analysis, because we often don't explicitly talk about capitalism and the reasons, you know, why the political ties between the U.S. and Israel, for example, are so strong. What does that have to do with the development of global capitalism over the last decades? And, you know, what does the prison industrial complex have to do with shoring up a capitalist system? That's oftentimes the elephant in the room. That's oftentimes that about which we do not speak, but it is central. It is absolutely central.
You have a very grand, radical freedom dream for dismantling capitalism, for abolishing policing and prisons, and for ending the occupation of Palestine. I mean, these are not short-term goals. These are not easy solutions that we're looking for here. And in all of those areas, we see progress and then we see retrenchment. We see two steps forward and then we see steps back, sometimes one, sometimes three. Given where we are right now on the question of Israel and Palestine, do you remain hopeful?
You know, I don't think that I get to decide on that basis. Of course, there are moments when we feel extremely distressed. And this is, you know, one of the tragic moments in our recent history. But I also should say that it takes time. It takes time. And oftentimes we are unable to see where we're headed. But we have to believe that it is possible to make change. And we can't give up. We can't give up. We can't not hope, because hope is the condition of all struggles.
We'll leave it there. Angela Davis, thank you so much for joining me on Up Front.
The past couple of weeks, I've been seeing Nelson Mandela's name pop up in conversation. And this week, I kept seeing the word divestment come up in conversation. And don't take my black card now, but loud as it's kept, it dawned on me that I don't remember too many details about South African apartheid my damn self. Ooh. And that's okay, because I know if I don't know, it's a lot of y'all that don't know either. And don't get me wrong, that one episode of A Different World in School Days did get me hip, but that one movie with Morgan Freeman is still a little bit hazy. So when I saw the students at Rutgers, Columbia University, NYU, Boston University, and Spelman College, shout out to my young Spelman sister, Rakaya Darbo, pulling out the same playbook, I thought it was time for us to have a refresher. So let's back it up a little bit. Apartheid refers to the system of institutionalized racial segregation that took place in South Africa from 1948 to the early 1990s, and not just an authoritarian government, but authoritarian political culture worked to ensure that South Africa was dominated politically, socially, and economically by the white population, even though they were the minority. They were split into one of four racial categories: white at the top, then Indian people of South Asian descent, then colored, multiracial South Africans, and then, of course, black South Africans. And because apartheid dictated housing and employment opportunities by race, this meant that between 1960 and 1983, over 3.5 million black South Africans were forcibly removed from their homes and stripped of their citizenship. And the people were not having it. Not there, not abroad. But back in 1960, them folks didn't have social media to show what atrocities were happening. And marching over here in the street wasn't going to do very much. So divestment was the way to go. AKA hit them in their pockets where it hurts. AKA remove your money from where your mouth is not. Amen? Divestment means no longer investing your money in something, period. That means stop opening your purse. That means if you have a business, sell off the business so you ain't got to be involved with it no more. And when the anti-apartheid protests started in the 1960s, colleges and universities were major players in the fight. Students began to pressure their schools to divest from companies who are doing business with South Africa, thereby forcing American companies to abandon the usual "my name's Bennett and I ain't in it" approach. And by 1988, 155 colleges had divested, and by the 90s, 90 cities and 26 states had taken a financial stance against South Africa. Between 1985 and 1990, over 200 American companies had cut all ties with South Africa, resulting in a loss of $1 billion in American investment. Woo! The children really are our future. And it worked, because guess what? All of this capital flight that was happening caused the devaluation of South African currency, and the inflation went crazy. Which, hold on now, because there's somebody out there divesting in us, because the inflation over here is nuts. Anyway, the success of this movement doesn't negate how risky supporting divestment was or the actual consequences it had for the people involved. Enter A Different World, Season 3, Episode 16, the one where the students are debating whether Hillman should divest. And of course, it seemed like a no-brainer at first, until it meant Kim, like many other students, would have to lose their jobs and their scholarships. Ooh, well, child. The episode aired in 1989, right in the thick of what was going on in the motherland. And while it was putting a hurt on the South African government for sure, it was also affecting the victims of apartheid in South Africa themselves, because it also affected their places of work and their ability to make money. Goodness gracious, I say. Now, Nelson Mandela joined the fight since the 1940s and had become a prominent leader by the 1950s. And while the movement had its peaceful beginnings, the apartheid regime responded violently, which prompted Mandela to establish an underground armed resistance group called the Spear of the Nation, or MK. And he was eventually arrested for these underground efforts in 1962 and was sentenced to life in prison in 1963. Mandela remained in prison for the next 27 years, and despite immense public pressure, he would not be released until apartheid ended in the 1990s. Meanwhile, even though American divestment numbers showed the U.S. was anti-apartheid, somehow Mandela stayed on our government's terrorist list till 2008. Make it make sense. Our government? Make sense? Have you seen how they're behaving outside right now? Girl, I don't think they're allowed to make sense. But wait, there's more. The parking lot will be ending early this year. What? I know. But why? Because I think it's time for me to stop running my mouth on the internet and come see y'all in person. Ha! Your girl going on tour. Celebration. Woo. I'm coming to a city near you. If you are in New York, if you are in D.C., if you are in Houston, if you're in Atlanta, if you're in L.A., beginning in December, I'm coming to see you. Tickets on sale next Friday.
Sometimes in this journalism business, it is hard to get the words exactly right, particularly in a situation that is complex and layered, which evokes so much deep emotion and conflict, and where people's lives are literally at stake. And given how brittle the feelings are, to the point where many Americans are afraid to say anything at all, we should be able to agree on a few fundamentals. First, that it is wrong to kill children. Whether they are Israeli children or Palestinian children, it is wrong to kill kids in a concert field or in a kibbutz or in a hospital. In fact, it is morally repugnant. If we can't agree on that, then we can't be friends. We should also agree that anti-Semitism is wrong, full stop, period. And it should horrify everyone that we're seeing attacks against Jewish people here and abroad, like the online messages threatening violence against Jewish students at Cornell University, or the anti-Semitic mob that stormed an airport tarmac in Russia, apparently searching for Jewish passengers on a flight from Israel. Or the Heil Hitler message projected on an interstate overpass in Georgia. None of this is okay, needless to say. And no matter how you feel about the government in Israel and what that government does, that is not an excuse to take out your anger on individual Jewish people, whether they're Americans or Israelis or British or random passengers on a plane. Keep in mind, some of your strongest allies in your outrage on behalf of Palestinians are Jewish. They are protesting beside you and getting arrested with you at those protests. And many of them are walking around in shock and horror and fear right now because of October 7th, worrying about their families and wondering who their friends are. Likewise, you can't judge every Palestinian or every Muslim or every Arab based on what Hamas did any more than you could have judged every American by the fact that some Americans elected a religious extremist, an religious extremist-backed wannabe autocrat, and now multiple indicted criminal whose MAGA movement tried to violently overthrow the government and still might. And again, it should be needless to say, being for Palestinians' freedom and staying alive does not mean you love Hamas or support them. The Hamas attack killed an estimated 1,400 people, including children, according to Israeli authorities. And as of tonight, the death toll in Gaza has topped 8,000 since October 7th, including 3,400 children, according to the Gaza Health Ministry. President Biden may say he doesn't believe Palestinians when they say how many of them have been killed. But reporting by news organizations like the AP, Reuters, the BBC, and our own reporters on the ground make it clear that the numbers of dead and the devastation in Gaza are staggering. The internet and some electricity have been turned back on, at least for now. And journalists and people in Gaza are still getting pictures out. So we can see with our own eyes that the situation is dire. And the violence goes beyond bombs. The U.S. is warning Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to rein in extremist settlers in the occupied West Bank in the wake of reports of violence against Palestinians there. According to the Associated Press, a Jewish settler shot and killed a Palestinian man who was harvesting olives near the West Bank city of Nablus. This means at least seven Palestinians have been killed by settlers since the latest violence broke out more than 3 weeks ago. With that as a backdrop, Netanyahu gave a war speech over the weekend that can only be described as a religious call to arms, citing a biblical reference when saying, quote, "You must remember what Amalek has done to you, says our holy Bible," unquote. Now, for those not familiar with the biblical term Amalek, here is the relevant quotation from 1 Samuel 15:3. "Now go, attack the Amalekites and totally destroy all that belongs to them. Do not spare them. Put to death men and women, children and infants, cattle and sheep, camels and donkeys." Which does not sound like self-defense. Frankly, it sounds a lot more like a call for genocide. Israeli jets have bombarded not just northern Gaza, but southern Gaza too, despite Israeli officials calling on the 2 million displaced Palestinians to flee south. And given these bombings are being done using our tax dollars, perhaps we should ask some questions. For example, how does bombing a densely populated land strip filled 50% with children constitute self-defense? How does bombing hospitals, churches, mosques, and UN schools constitute self-defense? Well, you say, if Hamas fighters are hiding in the hospital using the civilians as human shields, okay, let's say they are. Are you arguing that flattening the hospital and killing newborns in their incubators and their moms in the NICU, cancer patients, someone with a broken leg, the doctors, nurses, and just the women and kids hiding in the hospital, that that's not a war crime? Because you would be wrong, according to international law. Well, why don't the people in Gaza just turn over Hamas militants to the Israelis? Okay, how do you propose they do that? Hamas is the de facto government in Gaza, and they're the ones with the guns. The leaders of Hamas aren't even in Gaza, and if they were, if you were a teenager living in an open-air prison, getting bombed day and night by, let's say, Mexico, and Mexican police kicked in the door and raided your house anytime they wanted and turned off the water and cut off your food, what are you going to do? Side with them? Help them while you're dying? That's like asking why Black folks don't help or trust the police. Okay, but after 9/11, we bombed Afghanistan in self-defense. Yeah, we did. And did that put an end to Al-Qaeda or get bin Laden? No, it did not. Because like Hamas, bin Laden wasn't in the country we were bombing. President Obama got him 10 years later in Pakistan using special forces and without bombing scores of kids to death. Bombing Afghanistan did buy us a 20-year occupation that got us more enemies in the Muslim world when we scooped people up on the battlefield and dragged them off to Gitmo. And when we threw in a gratuitous war against Iraq based on lies by a Bush administration that traded on our anger and our fear, the world rose up against us as we committed torture and tossed former Iraqi police and soldiers into makeshift gulags, and those prisoners later turned into ISIS. Oh, and the Taliban are back in control of Afghanistan. So again, what is the goal of mass bombing Gaza? Is it to find the people Hamas militants abducted on October 7? Okay, how? By flattening whatever shelter they're taking from the bombs? Don't you risk killing them all by bombing them with the Palestinians? Just some relevant questions. And trust me, people do want answers. Over the weekend, protests erupted around the world with hundreds of thousands of demonstrators rallying in cities in Europe, the Middle East, Asia, Copenhagen, Rome, Stockholm, Kuala Lumpur. Scores took to the streets in the U.S., shutting down the Brooklyn Bridge in New York and a major highway in San Francisco. The call in each of these protests was for a ceasefire, a word that for some has somehow come to mean anti-Semitism and a lack of care about those who were brutally killed on October 7th, or even support for Hamas. So how then do you explain the family members of some of those being held by Hamas who are also calling for a ceasefire? And what would a ceasefire even mean? Well, it would literally mean both sides stop shooting. No more rockets into Israel, no more Israeli jets strafing Gaza. It would mean a prisoner swap negotiated by credible third parties, which sadly probably doesn't include us at this point. It would mean getting food, water, and medicine into Gaza and not pushing for 2 million Palestinians to expel themselves to Egypt or Jordan, likely to never be allowed to return. Hopefully, it would mean tamping down the McCarthyism and the doxing and anti-Semitism and Islamophobia and anti-Palestinian racism in our own country and in Europe. And then somebody, anybody, actually working to solve the real problem, which is a 56-year occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip that has sparked and will continue to spark vehement and, yes, even violent resistance, whether Hamas exists or not. It's a lot to unpack.